Senate will come to order. Members of the body that are down listening to the education information, but we have a quorum, so we will have message from the House.
Messages from the House of Representatives. Third reading, passed, amended, January 16, 2017. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 4, NRC Agreement State Amendments, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Numbers 82, Local Optional Sales and Use Taxes, ayes 54, noes 5, excused 1. Signed, Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Office, is that still going on down there in the education hearing? Okay. The Senate will stand at ease. We're going to do the rules. I think we need to have everybody here. We have some more messages. Okay, more messages.
From the House of Representatives, January 16, 2017, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Message number 101, House Bill 25, Dry Bean Commission Member Terms, ayes 59, excused 1. Message number 102, House Bill Number 38, School Finance Interfund Borrowing, ayes 56, noes 3, excused 1. Message number 103, House Bill Number 42, Education State Board of Education Membership, ayes 44, noes 15, excused 1. Signed, Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk.
That's it. Okay. Standing committee reports.
January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 1, to whom was referred Senate File 32, Peace Officer Recordings, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott, Senator Christensen, Chairman. January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 34, Student Personal Digital Information Protection Act, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger, Senator Coe, Chairman. January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 4, to whom was referred Senate File 36, Education Leader Evaluation and Support, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger, Senator Coe, Chairman. January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 4, to whom was referred Senate File 73, High School Graduation Requirements, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger, Senator Coe, Chairman. January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 37, Education Hathaway Scholarship Program 2, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger, Senator Coe, Chairman.
Okay. The next order of business will be the permanent rules adoption. Members of the Senate, you may recall last week we adopted temporary rules, the permanent rules of the 63rd legislative session. Procedurally, what we will do is there are amendments on your desk. Do you all have those amendments? Proposed amendments to our Senate rules? Do you have them? Okay, procedurally, what we'll do, we've adopted as our temporary rules, the permanent rules from the 63rd session. We will now have the proposed rules, which will be made to the temporary rules that we have in place, and then once those are voted up or down, we will go to the permanent rules. A motion will be in order to adopt those permanent rules, and we'll have a roll call vote. Am I right, Madam Chief Clerk? Okay. The first rule that we have under the Senate rules is 12-2. Hello? 12-2. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Okay, Mr. Well, first, I think, are we ready to go to...
We have that order of business, adoption, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate rules and joint rules previously adopted as the temporary rules of the Senate of the 64th Legislature, together with any amendments adopted by the Senate, be adopted as the permanent rules of the 64th Legislature.
You heard the motion. Before voting on that motion to adopt the temporary rules as the permanent rules, the Senate will first consider any proposed amendments to the temporary rules, what I just already said. Amendments to the temporary rules require simply a majority vote for adoption, and they certainly are debatable. With that, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I would move that Senate Rule 1 be adopted as an amendment to the rules, and I would call upon the good Vice President to explain this Senate Rule 1.
Reading clerk, read in that proposed rule.
Senate Rule 1. Senate Rule 12-2 is amended to read.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate Rule 1.
Want to move it?
I move Senate Rule, excuse me, Mr. President, I move Senate Rule 1 and hope ask for your favorable vote on this rule. It's actually not on here. So Senate Rule 1 is 12-2, disclosure of personal or private interest. And what this has to do with is we hope everybody realizes when they have a conflict of interest that they stand up and declare that. But in this case, sometimes through amendments or initial reading of the bill, you don't see you have a conflict. So what we've added to this language of this particular section of disclosure of personal or private interest is or at the first subsequent, thank you, time, the conflict becomes apparent to the declarer. So before, we always had you either stand up before you voted, or maybe you voted and then somebody amended it on second reading and you didn't realize that suddenly you do have a conflict. So we've given you the out that you can declare it at some other later point. And then you go down a little bit further and the new language says that the member later makes a declaration of no conflict of interest in the matter. Prompt entry of that declaration shall be made in the journal. So basically, if you change your mind later or the bill is amended in such a way that it no longer have a conflict and you make that declaration, what we wanted was it put into the journal. So it would record you making the statement of conflict of interest, but it never did record you withdrawing that. And then B is on general appropriations and recodification bills, a member who has declared a conflict of interest on a section or an amendment to a section shall not vote on that section, but may vote on the entire bill. So what you will see as new members when we do the budget, there'll be sections of the budget which the Appropriations Committee will explain to you. And on each section, if you have a conflict, and I can't give you a really good example, but you may have a conflict in that particular section because you are found to be personally profiting, maybe, from that section. You can declare a conflict when we go to vote on that section, but you can vote on the whole budget bill or a similar bill where we've broken it into sections. You can declare a conflict on that section and not vote, but you can vote when we do the whole bill. So that was another, we wanted to make sure that was very clear to the public and clear to you, too. So on Section C, renumbered in Section C, the rules, so the new language says, the Rules Committee shall report its ruling on the floor of the Senate, including an explanation of interest in question and any explanation for the ruling the committee determines appropriate to report to the Senate. Debate on the interest in question, the ruling may be had in accordance with the Senate rules governing debate. At the conclusion of any debate, the ruling of the Rules Committee shall be adopted as the ruling of the Senate, unless the motion is made, seconded by at least one other member, and carried by a majority vote of all the Senate members voting on the motion to rule differently. The proposed ruling of the Senate shall be set forth in motion. So, if you are not certain about a conflict of interest, and you ask for the Rules Committee to meet, and the Rules Committee will get back up in the corner there, or they'll go out into the conference room, and they'll discuss it with you, and they'll make a ruling. Come back in, the President of the Senate will explain the ruling to you. And that'll be the ruling of the Senate, unless you decide that you object to it, or you don't think the ruling is correct. They say no conflict, and you say, yes, that person has a conflict. So they've reported it to you. Debate on the interesting question and the ruling may be had in accordance with the Senate rules governing debate. So you can debate that. So somebody stands up and objects and says, I don't believe that's correct ruling by the committee. It's open for debate. Of course, you'll probably have the Rules Committee deciding that you are probably wrong, but that's up to you. You can do that. And at the conclusion of any debate, the ruling of the Rules Committee shall be adopted as the ruling of the Senate unless a motion is made, seconded by at least one other member. So you can make a motion, but you have to have it seconded and carried by a majority vote of all the Senate members voting on the motion to rule differently. So at the end, if you object to the ruling of the Rules Committee, and you get a second to that motion to object to how they came back and explained it to you, we will take a simple vote, a simple majority will rule the day. And the proposed ruling of the Senate shall be set forth in motion. So in other words, once we vote on it, we will then, and a simple majority wins. Whether it's what the Rules Committee came back with or whether what your objection was, that'll be the rule as to who wins that vote. As used in the section, personal or private interest, this is under little d, means the member shall receive or incur a direct financial gain or loss if the measure or bill is enacted. Personal or private interest does not include a financial gain or loss which shall be received or incurred by a member if the gain or loss shall also be received or incurred by a substantial class of persons. And you can argue nonstop what a substantial class is. But the reality is that you, if you're going to stand to personally gain from something that's done here or something that's removed or deleted out of statute, and you think that you are a minority group, that's about the only way you can do that. Substantial class pretty much is open for interpretation. But if you think out of the 500,000 people live in Wyoming, there's only probably 10 or 20 of you that are going to receive any gain from this, then you would be not a substantial class. That is left up to you. All this is left up to you to declare or not declare. But we're trying to define what a personal or private interest means. And it basically, if you're a substantial part of a substantial class, you aren't gaining a personal or private interest. But that is up for your interpretation. So, Mr. President, that is the rule changes we're going to make. I stand for questions.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I have a couple of questions and a comment and an objection to a part of the rule. Mr. President, as I read this, and I'm going to use a personal example here, I have always felt and have declared that I have a conflict of interest when we talk about, we have something on the lease rate for state lands or something fundamental like the length of term in a lease in state lands. Family ranching corporation, old state leases. I feel I've got a personal private interest. This is an area, Mr. President, where there was an attorney general's opinion that said legislators in that circumstance were part of a substantial class and did not have to declare that as a conflict of interest. I think the Attorney General in this respect, in this instance, is flat out wrong. But as I read this rule, if I were to go to the Rules Committee and they were to say, no, you don't have a conflict, you got to vote, that would put a stop to me voting unless I appealed to the Senate and went through this voting thing. But I think the way I read this rule, I don't have to go to the Rules Committee. I think I know how they rule. I just declare the conflict of interest, and that's the end of it. And if that's correct, I think we can perfectly well live with that kind of circumstance. I think it's cut and dried. I think many of the other people in similar circumstances would find it cut and dried, and we can proceed. Second, on the item D on the back page, it speaks strictly, as I read it, to a financial gain or loss. And I expressed this to the Rules Committee, as I recollect. I think that is a mistake. The Senate has traditionally, in the confirmation process, had an occasional circumstance where somebody's asked to vote on the confirmation of a spouse or another relative, and they have declared a conflict of interest on that, and it's been the tradition here. I think it's entirely appropriate. And this rule ignores that factor. So I think we should not adopt subsection D, Mr. President. I will also say that, and the presenter highlighted this, that there's a lot of dispute as to what a substantial class is, and I don't have a better answer. Obviously, we need something. Let me give you an extreme example, Mr. President. If we were to have a vote on the sales tax exemption on groceries, food, we all eat, we would all pay. If there was a tax increase there by removing that exemption, we'd all pay it. Obviously, you can't have people declaring a conflict of interest on that, even though it's going to cost them money. It's a substantial class. It's all of us. That's what a representative government's all about. So in the extreme case, you clearly have that. But I think the custom has carried it way too far to the point where people are getting personal livelihood in good part off things that we're voting on. I don't think it's appropriate. But that's a matter of degree, and that's probably why you have a Rules Committee process, so you can deal with those matters of degree openly and whatnot, Mr. President. But I think this thing, by not allowing, by limiting the conflict of interest to strictly financial matters and not dealing with the circumstances where it's a non-financial matter, where we've got a personal relationship, I think that's a mistake. And I think it would be a mistake to adopt subsection D at this time. And, Mr. President, I'm a little at loss as to how to proceed. Can we lay it back for further amendment? Can we separate it out? What's the best procedural way to handle that kind of thing? Because I think the rest of the rule is fine.
Mr. Vice President?
Mr. President, because our rules say that all amendments need to be in writing, I would suggest that we lay this back. I would also apologize for not having gone beyond my screen here and seeing that there is a second part of the rule, which is the harassment and obfuscation of the delay tactics. So I really do need to explain that, which is new language. I've got it here. That's why I wondered if this was the bribery and other offers.
Point of order, please address the chair, Senator von Flader. What are we talking about?
After it goes past this section D, which is in question at the moment, mine then continues on down through ethics complaints, which is Joint Rule 22-1. Is that the part we didn't adopt today? Okay.
We don't need that. I didn't understand
what
you were saying.
Yeah, okay. I was just clarified, Mr. President. Sorry about that. That was not changed, and the new language I have is not what was adopted.
Would you like to, anyone like to respond to Senator Scott's concerns from the Rules Committee? Mr. Marotta, floor leader.
Mr. President, the first thing I would do is respond to the initial concern that the good senator from Neturnah County has raised on the C paragraph, whether or not the example provided of a personal conflict would be ruled against the declaration of conflict by the individual. And the first sentence of C that would remain, if a member is uncertain whether his interest in a bill is such as to require him to abstain from voting, he may request a ruling from the Rules Committee. Absent that request, there would not be a ruling by the Rules Committee. So if the member felt that it was a conflict, that would suffice, and there would not need to be a ruling by the Rules Committee. So I believe that concern would be taken care of. Mr. President, the second concern regarding the personal or private interest and having that personal interest aspect, when we discussed it in the Rules Committee, I'm afraid that I had thought that we had it correct and that we adopted some other previous language, and the good Vice President and I conferred on this, and that was an oversight. So, Mr. President, what I would suggest that we do at this point in time, without objection, would be to lay this back for long enough to get a written amendment put together that remedies that. It's just a short two-word addition, and then come back and rework the rule if that would be acceptable to the body.
Well, we have today, we have to have the final decision made on these rules. So, without objection, we will lay this back until we make the changes that we need to do, and I think this will take care of my good colleague from Neturnah County's concerns, but we will vote on these today, members of the Senate. So without objection, we'll lay these rules back at this particular time. Reports from standing committees. Any more reports?
January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 9, to whom was referred Senate File 78, Federal Natural Resource Policy Account, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. January 16, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 10, to whom was referred Senate File 62, Telepharmacy Amendments, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Okay, what I would suggest we've laid, Senator Scott.
Mr. President, which bill? I'm sorry, I was being consulted. 67?
No. You stood up to be recognized, Senator Scott. I'm recognizing.
I'm confused as to where we were. Okay, no.
Okay, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that bill, that point, consideration of bills on general file. Do you have a motion?
Sure. Mr. President,
I move that the committee resolve itself into committee, itself into committee of the whole.
Back into.
Well, fine. As amended, I make that motion.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Senator Kinski. And while Senator Kinski's coming up here, Mr. Minority Floor Leader and Senator from Neturnah County, let's work on that and try to get that. We've got to get that done today, so we will get it done.
There you go.
Thank you. The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 69. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 69, Small Employer Health Reinsurance Program Amendments, an act relating to insurance, sponsored by the Labor Committee. Was referred to committee number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Having heard the bill, what is the pleasure of the group? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee of the whole rise to 42
one second.
Recommendation that Senate File 69 do pass I believe there is no standing committee amendment, and I will explain what's going on here. Members of the Senate, we have a entity known as the Wyoming Small Employer Health Reinsurance Program, which is also referred to by the acronym WISERP, which we're putting in the statute. You can see that at the bottom of the first page. This was an important aspect of the small employer program we've had in this state ever since, I believe it came in the early 1990s. We were the second state in the country to adopt one of these, so we were pioneering at that time. It has a guarantee issue provision in it, which, as the authors of the ACA have learned to their sorrow, can get you in trouble because you can get some very sick people, and if you don't do it carefully, you can create a death spiral within your insurance program where the costs go way up. And this was a device to avoid that. It was quite active. We've had as many as 12 different small employer carriers ceding lives into this reinsurance pool. And what's happened is basically the ACA came along and destroyed the competitive market here, and we're down to one carrier with 23 lives. And the board of the program decided that it's time to let the program go to sleep and run out its book of business and gradually go out of business. And they came to the Joint Interim Committee last year and then again this year, and this bill is the result. And what the bill basically does is it doesn't repeal the program. It modifies the board to reflect that we no longer have the competitive marketplace, Mr. Chairman, we used to have with multiple carriers. We're down to two. We had a maximum of 14. We're down to two. And this reflects what's happened all across the country, but particularly in the smaller states like this. That thing destroyed our competition. And with two people, the current board size just doesn't work. You need to get knowledgeable people. You don't want a majority from any one carrier. So they're reducing, and you can see it on page two, the number of people on the board, and basically giving the authority to, as I said, run out the business, not take any more lives in, simplifies the requirements for a plan of operation. Okay, but we are not repealing it. And the reason we're not repealing it is that it's very clear the current situation with the ACA, regardless of whoever was going to win the election, and of course we now know that, but whoever was going to, the thing was in the process of collapsing, and something different was going to happen. And so we wanted to retain the flexibility of reviving this pool if we needed it. And given the results of what's happened and what's going on in D.C. currently, I think that just demonstrates the wisdom of retaining the pool on a standby basis where the insurance commissioner can reappoint the board, get a new plan of operation, and, Mr. Chairman, proceed to use this again if we need it. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the summary of the bill. I would say at the peak of its activity, well, in total, there were 1,170 lives that were ceded into the pool at one time or another. That means people for whom the pool was acting as a reinsurer, basically. And it's, the testimony was, as I recall, it was down to 23. So its current usefulness is not there, but we may well face a circumstance where it will once again be useful. So I would urge the adoption of this bill that keeps the thing available if we need it, but allows them to do what they think under current circumstance makes sense, which is to run the thing out and cease the operation. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Further discussion? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question on this. Are we preempting something that may be occurring once ACA is removed and we'll have to go back in and put things back in, or have we left it so that this board can operate if ACA is removed and we have more competition?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the latter. That's why we're not repealing the thing wholesale. We want to have it available if we need it, and we're giving the insurance commissioner the ability to reactivate the thing. And I think that's wise, rather than have the full legislature have to reenact it. We may well have to move suddenly if there's an ongoing failure in the ACA while Washington is deciding what they want to replace it with. So we need it available on a rapid basis, and we're trying to retain our flexibility to deal with what's going to be a very uncertain environment for the next few years. And so that's the way the bill is written the way it is, and it's intended to bring it back without having to have legislative action. Now, Mr. Chairman, it is entirely possible if they have to bring it back, the next thing that'll happen is they'll come to us and say the environment has changed in such a way that we need to modify something statutorily. But they can function without us for long enough to get by until we can consider any changes and until they can understand any changes that are needed, which may be a further problem, Mr. Chairman. So that's what this bill does, and I again urge its adoption.
Further discussion on Senate File 69. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 69, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Senate File 69 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 6. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 6, Radioactive Waste Storage Facilities Amendments, an act relating to radioactive waste storage facilities, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, excused Senator Coe. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Having heard the reading of the bill, what is your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 6. There is an amendment. I'd like it read in at this time.
Senate File 6, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 6, line 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you. I move Standing Committee Number 1 amendment to Senate File 6. And to explain this fine bill, I'll call on myself. What this is...
Chair recognizes you then.
Oh. So what this does is updates our statutes, which are done in about 1996, is the closest we could guess that these statutes were written. And what it does is says for a radioactive waste storage facility and a temporary radioactive waste storage facility at that, that the government will have to do, will have to put in place a permanent storage. And we have nothing in mind as far as creating or talking to a company or implementing this. We just want to update our statutes. And so what it does is it goes to the application on the second page, top of the second page, the application process, it says that we've updated that from $500,000, struck that language, and put $800,000 in it, plus any excess amount collected from the feasibility agreement pursuant to Wyoming statute. And what that feasibility agreement is, you can do an informal feasibility agreement prior to actually applying, and you have to pay money. And any money that was left over after that feasibility agreement would also be applied to this. The amount of, and then we said we allowed the DEQ to inflate the application fee for the cost of living. So that's what the rest of that language does. Shall be adjusted for inflation by the department using the Consumer Price Index or its successor, blah, 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 so forth. Then you go down to page 4. And upon receipt of the application under subsection B of this section, the director shall, at the earliest possible dates, the new language in there is the director may apply for other funds which may become available to the states under any other federal or state program for high-level radioactive waste storage facilities. This allows DEQ to apply if there is federal money involved that would allow that to happen. You could use it for your feasibility study, or you could use it later when there's an actual application out there. But once again, let me re-emphasize or emphasize the fact that we have no company that is applying to the state. We are just updating our statutes in case this should ever happen. Preparations of the report, new language on page 4, line 17, it says, A, except as otherwise provided in this subsection, department shall within 21 months, they struck 18 months, that was the time we gave the department to do the feasibility studies via the once an application is received. We've upped that from 18 to 21 months to give them a couple more months to do the actual study. The bottom of page 4, line 23, starts, the director may determine that more than 21 months is required to complete the report if he can't do it in 21 months. And if the director makes that discretion, the director shall extend the deadline as appropriate, notify the applicant and the legislature of the additional time required. We struck out on page 5, line 17, where we said to the extent practicable. Thank you. So what we were doing there was, it was very squishy language as to whether he'd go out for public comments. And so we said the director shall hold public hearings to receive the comments on the report instead of allowing him to go out if he thought it would happen or he could make it happen. So we said he definitely will go out for a public comment on any of the reports. Page 6, top of the line, starts
Senator
with
Von Slattern.
Yes.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment. I'd ask if the side conversation is going to go on for a substantial period of time, if you might just step outside the chamber. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Please resume, Senator Von Slattern.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Page 1 on line, on page 6, line 1, we took out the reference to Yucca Mountain. If you remember, Yucca Mountain was in the process of being built in the mid-90s, and it was actually going to be the permanent waste storage facility. So we could set up a temporary waste storage facility once Yucca Mountain was created, and now we know that it's about $1 billion or $2 into it, but it's not going to be a permanent waste storage facility, at least we don't think so. So line 3 and the very top of that paragraph also cuts out Yucca Mountain. And then we went down to feasibility agreement. The applicant shall pay the state a fee of $800,000. And then once again, we said they can raise that cost with the consumer price index, so we don't have to come back every year and adjust it to be $805,000, $810,000 the next year. We allowed him to update it as needed. And then injunction proceedings, we said $10,000. In addition to being subject to injunctive relief, any person convicted of violating any provisions of this article may be imprisoned for up to 1 year. And we struck out $5,000 and said the fine could be up to $10,000. What I was... And so what the amendment does is go to page 6, You go to the top of the page, line 2, strike, submitted to the President of the United States. That's how they did it back then. We're not sure that they would actually submit their feasibility study to the President of the United States along with license application for Yucca Mountain. So we said that they would, in accordance with law, so if they have to do a feasibility study for a permanent radioactive waste storage facility, such as what Yucca Mountain was proposed to be, we weren't sure that they would have to submit that to the President of the United States. So we just said in accordance with the law, and the federal regulations will kick in at that point. But I also want to point out in that paragraph that it also says, following any public review, start on page 5, line little b, following any public review, the report is brought in the section, but in no event, before the United States Department of Energy issues a final environmental impact statement, submitted to the President, struck out, submitted to the President of the United States, in accordance with law, the United States, along with a license application for a permanent repository for high-level radioactive waste. In other words, we can never do anything for a temporary storage or storage of radioactive waste in this state until the federal government has accepted the environmental impact statement and taken the licensed application for a permanent mineral storage facility somewhere in the United States. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that the amendment be dispensed with. It says submitted to the strike President of the United States and submitted in accordance with law.
Further discussion on amendment number 1 to Senate File 6. Further discussion? All those in favor of Senator Von Fladen's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 6, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File Amendment, Standing Amendment number 1 to Senate File 6 is adopted. Further discussion back on the bill.
Question.
Further discussion. Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Von Fladen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 6, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 6 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 67. The reading clerk, please read the bill.
Senate File 67, CHIP Program Amendments, an act relating to the Child Health Insurance Program, sponsored by the Labor Committee, was referred to Committee Number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 67 do pass. There was no standing committee amendment, and I'll explain the bill. Mr. Chairman, the bill does two things. There's an extensive rewrite on page 2, and that's just taking a great big long run-on sentence and putting it out in little subparagraphs so it's easier to understand. It doesn't do anything substantive to the program. That just, we took advantage of having a bill to clean up the statutes and make them easier to read. What the bill does as a substantive matter is entirely contained on page 3, lines 1 and 2. This is in the Child Health Insurance Program. Do you remember it preceded the ACA? We've been in it for a dozen years or more. Been a successful program. And the federal government in 2009 adopted legislation that requires that all services be available through a managed care, and you see the federal statutory references there. The testimony we had in committee was, and that we got from the current organization that manages this program for us, was that that would apply to them and that it would increase the cost of the program substantially. The feds finally got around to defining in rule and regulation what they wanted last April, and this is the first session we've had since then, so that's why the bill is before you now. The testimony from the Health Committee, from the Health Department, was that if we do not adopt this provision, it is their belief that we will lose the federal match on this child health program, and that the price tag on that will give you a choice. Either drop the child health insurance program, which I don't think we want to do. It does a lot of good for a lot of people. Or we find $15 million more a year to pay for it. That's what we're getting out of the feds for. So this one, Mr. Chairman, if you vote it down, there's a significant price tag to that action. And a very, well, very nasty decision followed, I suspect, by a nasty the $15 million price tag. Classic case of how the feds get you into something and then change the rules in ways that are potentially expensive that we may not like, but we don't have much choice in it. They also said, in the Appropriations Committee, if they're around, please take note, that they think the ACA repeal may drop our match from 88% to 65%, and that'll cost money too. So it's all kinds of good news in this bill, Mr. Chairman. But that's the basics of it, that we've got to have this provision. The people have to implement it, say it would be expensive. They did not say how expensive. And I don't think they know. And we'll see, they're in the process of rebidding the thing, so I guess we'll find out. But right now, the federal government, which is the source of the cause, will pay 88%, except if there's a repeal there, they might go down to 65%. Well, we've got to do it, or we have a very nasty and expensive decision to make. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the pros and the cons in the bill. I would urge its adoption. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Further discussion on Senate File 67. Further discussion on Senate File 67. Hearing no further discussion, ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 67, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 67 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate Joint Resolution 2. The reading clerk, please read the resolution.
Senate Joint Resolution 2, Federal Land, Wind, and Solar Energy Revenue, State Share, a joint resolution requesting Congress to enact legislation requiring revenues received by the federal government from wind and solar energy developments on lands of the United States be shared equally with the state in which those developments are located. Sponsored by Senator Driscoll. Was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Excused, Senator Coe. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the resolution. What's your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report. It does so with a do pass recommendation on Senate Joint Resolution 2, and to explain this fine bill, I'll ask you to please call on Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the body, this is a joint resolution. This resolution deals with wind development and solar development on federal lands. What the resolution does is it petitions Congress and to enact legislation. So if you go over to page 2, Section 1, this is what the bill does. It says that Congress speedily enact legislation providing for the payment of 50% of all rents fees received by the federal government in connection with wind and solar energy developments on federal lands, that those fees would be transferred to the state, similar to what we do now. So the concept here is right now, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hicks.
The concept, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Driscoll. Mr. Chairman, the concept is right now when we receive, we have federal minerals, that 50% of those federal minerals as they're developed the taxes on those are transferred to the state. This just it brings in that same concept that if there's going to be revenues generated on wind power or solar on federal lands, that 50% of the fees that the federal government receives would be transferred to the state. And we're just asking that Congress enact legislation to do so. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would allow Senator Driscoll to stand for any questions.
Senator Driscoll.
I mean, I have some questions.
Further discussion on the... Well, there is further discussion. We goaded him into it. No, he sat back down. Further discussion. Senator Driscoll.
And thank you very much. Being as is my bill, I better say just a couple words on it. A little bit further explanation. We do have this process in place. We use it right now on all of our minerals, on everything else, and merely gets back to Wyoming. What's only fair is what we produce off of our grounds should come back at least in part to us. I encourage you to vote yes.
Thank you. Further discussion. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we have Senate joint resolutions come before the body, it just I remember a former president of the Senate and what he thought about generally joint resolutions. And, in the end, Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if the effect is such that if we anticipate this really do more after we put our 49-cent stamp on it and mail it back, that it, what particular round file in Washington, D.C., it will find itself. And these things make a difference. And so anyway, while the sentiment is very, the sentiment, it's hard to argue with the sentiment and the value of the, that would be nice. The effect of joint resolutions is such that, long story short, I'll be voting no just because, not because I don't like the principle, but because I don't think these kind of resolutions do very much good.
Further discussion. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, is my distinguished colleague saying that the amount of impact they have is not worth 49 cents? We aren't buying 49 cents worth of impact with this thing? Mr. Chairman, if that's what he's saying, I think maybe I even agree with him.
Further discussion. Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, there's some very good points that have been made by my colleagues across the room. But in this case, we actually have a different one. We've been told this concept is floating Congress, and they're looking for support from wherever they can. And a support from a Western state that's directly affected by it directly can have some effect. When a state says they'd like something, it does help our colleagues in Congress to help get what is justly due for the state of Wyoming.
For the discussion on Senate Joint Resolution 2, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Fladen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate Joint Resolution 2, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate Joint Resolution 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 37. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 37, Education Hathaway Scholarship Program 2, an act relating to the Hathaway Scholarship Program, sponsored by the Education Committee, was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wathenberger. Senator Coe, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, move when Committee of the Whole rise and report. Do so with the do-pass recommendation on Senate File 37, and there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate File 37, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, lines 2 through 4.
Mr. Chairman, move that standing committee amendment, and for an explanation of the bill and the standing committee amendment, defer to Senator Ellis.
Senator Ellis.
All righty. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This morning, the Senate Education Committee took up Senate File 37, which deals with the Hathaway Scholarship Program and more specifically would modify the success curriculum requirements. So we'll go through the five substantive changes that would amend the bill. So first, I would draw your attention to page 2, lines 3 through 7. We looked at the definition of GPA, and you can see some added language with the intent to weight grades as they're considered for the success curriculum requirements of Hathaway. Moving along, you'll see we also added some clarity to the definition of semester hour, and that one's pretty straightforward without a lot of discussion. We're just trying to make that language a little bit more clear. Going along, the next substantive change is to 21-16-1307, and this deals with, the success curriculum test standards. So on page 2, you'll see the date that we've made, we've changed the date to begin from 2017 through 2018 school year. And then more specifically on page 3, lines 1 through 6, during the interim, the committee looked at deleting the language that you see stricken there. And as you may know, Romanet 3 of 21-16-1307 requires that our students that are applying for this scholarship take 4 years of math, 4 years of language arts, and then 4 years of science. During the interim, there was some discussion about paring that down to 3 years, but during the committee hearing this morning, we adopted an amendment that would reinstate that language. So if you're looking for some of those classes that would be still included and required, things like Physics 1, Physics 2, Chemistry 1, Chemistry 2, Biology 1, Biology 2, Geology 1, Computer Science, Physical Science, and then a catch-all, an additional science course. Moving beyond that, the next and final substantive change would be on 21-16-1307, subsection F. This section of the statute sets forth requirements under this article that are to be aligned with the student content and performance standards. Right now, the Wyoming Department of Ed, through rules and regs, currently requires school districts to provide a list of courses which satisfy the success curriculum requirements. Here, I draw your attention to the proposed language. The committee adopted language to define functional of equivalence of courses, and those can but aren't necessarily limited to career, technical ed, art and music honor courses, college-level courses, and then some other courses offered through Wyoming Statute 2120-201, and those deal with courses where you have a school district that has an agreement with community colleges or the university so that that student can be getting some college courses. Moving on to Section 3, this act would take immediate effect, mainly because it doesn't require any implementation. It just changes the standards for which students apply for the scholarship. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Discussion on Senate File 37, the amendment to Senate File 37. Question having been called for on the amendment number 1 to Senate File 37. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 37, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment, that amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 37, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 37, Senate File 37 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 32. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 32, Peace Officer Recordings, an act relating to public records, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable consideration on Senate File 32, Peace Officer Recordings. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that it be read in.
Senate File 32, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, lines 20 through 23.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that amendment. And then to present the bill will be Senator Nethercott.
Thank you. Senator Nethercutt.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, fellow senators. I think for a matter of clarity, even though we're on the amendment, that it's helpful to explain the bill in total and how that amendment fits into this bill. So if you would please just follow along with me as we go through this. This particular bill relates to police officer body cameras and also their in-car cameras for any police officer video recordings and or audio recordings. So if we go to page 2, it starts off with the definitions for what a peace officer recording actually is, and it means any audio or video data recorded by a peace officer in the course of their employment and performing their official duties. Moving down the page to the middle of the page on page 2, this provides for the right of inspection pursuant to the Public Records Act for this audio or digital recordings. So subparagraph D on line 17 reads, the custodian shall deny the right of inspection of the following records unless otherwise provided by law. Some explanation there as to what unless otherwise provided by law may mean, and that can be found in the public record statutes currently on the books, mainly relating to pending open investigations by law enforcement or county attorney's offices, which that information typically is not subject to a public records request. So that provides some explanation as to that particular piece. As we move down, the amendment here replaces the following language. It deletes lines 20 through 23 on page 2, as well as lines 1 through 3 on page 3, and it's then replaced with the amendment. It's important to note that with this particular amendment, this was reached with considerable collaboration and consensus by the task force throughout the course of the last couple of years. The consensus and collaboration came from, like, the civil liberties groups, the media, law enforcement groups, and so there was no opposition to this amendment. I think that's very important to note here as we move through what this amendment actually states. So when we look at the amendment found on page 1 there, the language that's being added is information obtained through a peace officer recording. So the custodian of one of these recordings shall allow the right of inspection to law enforcement personnel or public agencies for the purpose of conducting official business or pursuant to a court order. So what this is stating is that the custodian of the record of the audio recording or the digital recording will turn it over to other public agencies. It says shall do so. So some of those other public agencies that are contemplated are like the Department of Family Services when they're doing a cooperative investigation where that information may be relevant. Moving down to subparagraph B, the custodian may allow the right of inspection under the following circumstances. One, to the person in interest. My fellow senators know the person in interest is defined in statute under the Public Records Act. So that is statutorily defined as a term of art. Subparagraph 2, if the information involves an incident of deadly force or serious bodily injury, also as defined by statute. Subparagraph 3, in response to a complaint against a law enforcement personnel and the custodian of the information determines inspection is not contrary to the public interest. And then the final ability is in the interest of public safety. And so for that, I would ask for a favorable consideration of the amendment.
Question on the amendment. Senator Perkins.
On the amendment, question about the amendment, Mr. Chairman. So we get down looking in particular on line 18 of the amendment. So the custodian may allow the right of inspection if the information involves an incident of deadly force or serious bodily injury as defined in that particular section. And I guess to whom may the custodian allow that? Is that anybody who has a purient interest in what happened? Or does that make that essentially a public record on request? And I guess the other thing would also on Roman numeral 4 on the bottom line, page 26, again, to whom? Who makes the determination whether or not that is a matter of public safety? Who gets to make that application to the custodian, and then how does the custodian make those determinations?
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I was on the Digital Information Privacy Task Force when we came up, I think, with the original bill. So I'm trying to look at the amendment. We had a lot of discussion in the task force that we felt the court order was an important aspect of this, and that and I see where, at least as I read this, that all that information, all the language about the court order is deleted, and then the custodian is given this permissive right to release the information. And I think I'm having trouble with this, Mr. Chairman, because what it's saying is that the custodian shall give it to other law enforcement agencies, et cetera, but that the custodian may allow the right of inspection to these other people. That doesn't seem to me to bridge the public interest very well, nor does it have the, you know, our thinking in the task force is you go to a judge and state your case. But here, and we had a lot of things about, if you make the custodian the keeper of the information, then there may be reasons why law enforcement may decide not to release information, especially if it's not all that, say it doesn't present an officer in good light. And I know that, you know, it happened, there's both sides of all this. But if it's permissive to the custodian, I think that's probably a bad way to go. So I'd like to learn more about that and the thinking that went into this. It seems to be exact opposite direction of what we had in the task force, if I'm following this correctly.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, too, with the authors of this amendment, if we could have some explanation on the amendment, line 24, why it's worded in the negative of not contrary to the public interest. I'm just kind of curious why it's worded that way. Thank you.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman and members of the body, I was a no in committee on this particular amendment, and I'd like to articulate some of my concerns why. And part of the testimony is when we look at the burden of responsibility now is shifted upon the custodian of that record, that they may or may not disclose this information. And my concern with the very rural district that I have, that a lot of these custodians, which may be police departments, are composed of one individual, or maybe two. And the way this is worded now, it says may, but you could literally tie up, and some of the testimony that we had from one of the organizations that represents these people was, is that's a substantial amount of work when you get one of these requests that come in there and says, I want to inspect the public record. And that custodian then is going to have to sit down and go through that, make a determination, may have to redact some of that information that's distributed. So I've got a lot of concerns on the impact of this particular amendment on how it does with these very, very small police departments or municipalities or these other entities that may at some point be the custodial of those records. So it's a concern I raised in committee. It's still a valid concern, Mr. Chairman. But I did vote against this, and I just wanted to establish this is went ahead and supported the bill because I think the bill as a whole, and I won't talk about the bill, Mr. Chairman. But that's my concerns with the amendment.
Senator Nethercutt.
Mr. Chairman, if I may address some of those concerns. Regarding the concern about getting a court order, this particular statutory language does not remove the ability of someone to get a court order upon the denial of the request for a public record. So 16.4203 subsection E provides the statutory guidance for what an individual or entity can do when a public record request is denied. And so that applicant for that public record can still petition the court contesting that decision by a law enforcement agency or any other agency to deny them that request for a public record. So I think that's important to note, or at least that's my understanding of the legislation. The other concerns as to subparagraph 3, as to why that language may be written in the negative concerning subparagraph 3, which reads, in response to a complaint against a law enforcement personnel and the custodian of the information determines inspection is not contrary to the public interest. It's my understanding that this language was written that way because under the Public Records Act, a determination has to be made under 16.4203B that the disclosure would not be contrary to the public interest, and so it's consistent with current statutory language.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, one of the witnesses last Friday, a chief of police of a certain large metropolitan area where we may reside, talked about the impact of public records request. Talked about the impact of public records request in the redacting process. And he said what they were seeing was for 1 hour, a request of 1 hour of videotape, they ended up having about 3 hours of work going into it to make sure juveniles, certain things weren't inadvertently released. And then he went on to give the example of a request not long ago where an individual had made a request for a month's worth of an officer's videotapes or recordings. And then he changed it to a year. And if you multiply that year by three on all those hours, that's when they start talking about the impact and why without some boundaries, this tool becomes financially backbreaking to an organization. And so the options are still there to go to the court order and explain why you need more. But it all is also an answer to a department so they don't, under today's lack of clarity on it, don't have their bank broken with those kind of requests.
Further discussion on Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 32. Senator Bouchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I look at this and I look at the part where the person of interest may get the video. That looks like a big problem to me. But I look and I'm sympathetic to what the police are having a problem with body cams. And I say this bill is just not ready for prime time because we have two different things. We've had three decades of standing ability to get FOIA requests from police video, meaning the police car video. But I see the differences of having the body cam where they're in the house or they're talking to a juvenile or a victim. And I think they're two different things. I think the police, the courts have ruled that the video that are out on the streets when a police car is out on the street, that those videos have been opened to the public. And so by contrast, the body cam is a whole new thing that has come up more recently. And so I don't think this is ready for prime time because I think there's two situations here. One where we'd be violating, like I said, three decades of standing FOIA requests and court cases that have been upheld to do so. And at the same time, I'm sympathetic to the police having the body cams on. So like I said, I don't think this bill is ready yet.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the amendment, there was a question earlier about in the interest of public safety and what that meant. And the example that was given to us again in the committee may have to do with an act of violence in a community or a shooting of a public safety officer or something like that where they need to be able to release information right away. And that just gives them some latitude. But again, it's on and for the amendment. Question on the amendment.
Are you ready for the question? Nope. Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, I would like some information about, maybe this isn't the right time to talk about this, but
Senator Barnard, I think you need to get closer to your microphone. I've got you.
I would like some information, Mr. Chairman, in regards to this amendment as what happens if somebody violates this, if this person in interest or one of these other people gets a video and misuses it. What are the ramifications of this, and how are there any kind of punishment, or what happens when this happens?
Further discussions, Senator Nethercutt.
Mr. Chairman, there is nothing that happens if the person of interest is typically, as defined by statute, and that's typically the person who's the subject of the audio recording or the video recording. And so if they are in a position to receive a copy of that, they can do with it what they will. So if they want to put themselves on YouTube, on any kind of public media, they certainly can. But there's no ramifications to them if they do.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 32, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
The amendment has, the motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 32 has failed. We're back on the bill. Division. A division having been called for. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to adopt Standing Committee Number Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 32, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Fourteen, the motion to adopt Standing Committee pardon? Chair votes aye. Do I need to stand up to do that? Should I stand up? Okay. Okay, the motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 32 has passed. We're back on the bill. Further discussion? Senator Christensen.
On the bill, on and for the bill, Mr. Chairman, the testimony we had, we talked about it briefly, is without some sideboards on what these videos record, there's a couple things going on. First, there's the cost of dealing with the requests, and that's important to know. But the bigger reason is about public privacy, about an individual's privacy. And when that officer comes to your door and knocks on that door, and all he's there for is to say, is that your dog on the road, which it isn't, of course. As you open that door, that camera records everything in front of it. It records the state of your home. It may record what you have out on the desk. It may record anything. And if he's invited in, that camera continues to roll. It's the same thing when you talk to an officer in his patrol car on the street. If the cameras or the body cams are rolling, what used to be a casual conversation about, I'm worried about my neighbor's child, now, if that could be on YouTube that night, it really puts a chilling effect on the interaction between an individual and public safety officers. And so I think we really need to take this bill pretty serious. I think the primary benefit is the public, both on recording the interaction and protecting the public's interest, protecting the officer's interest, but also keeping it reasonable. It's not just about officer safety or hot situations. It's about what those cameras can record all day long. And let's be careful with this. When we've had some agencies testify that without limits, not only is it a budget issue, but they're not comfortable with having recorded everything in front of that officer and then having it available to be on Facebook or YouTube that night. Purpose of the bill, standing for the bill.
Further discussion, Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, on for the bill, Mr. Chairman, we did a lot of work in the interim through the Digital Information Privacy Task Force on this, and it's an important issue because right now, as statute exists, there really is no limitation on the public records requests related to police body cameras. In other words, if they get the video, you can make a public records request for it. And unless there's an investigation ongoing and it's actually evidentially excluded, then you'll be able to access that. As a result of that, only about 25% of the police departments and sheriffs around the state are willing to use it because they're concerned about the privacy rights of the individuals, as the good senator from the northwestern part of the state indicated. So we don't have adoption. And yet, at the same time, almost everyone in the law enforcement community is convinced that that the use of body cameras is good both for the police department and for the public. In nearly every circumstance, just to make sure that everybody's doing the right thing, we know what's happening, and that there's accountabilities both ways. When these have been adopted, complaints have gone down, problems have gone down, and that adoption has been very positive. So the task force was absolutely compelled and convinced that it's positive for law enforcement to adopt the body cameras, but law enforcement is unwilling to do so unless those individual privacy protections are in place. The intent, then, is to put together a package that respects that and draws that balance, recognizing that sometimes we'll need to release information, sometimes we'll need to protect it, and going into the Public Records Act and coming up with a clear delineation was really the essential point. As my colleague from right here in Laramie County noted, this is a piece of legislation that all of the key players have been involved in the drafting of, and they're all on board, which is a difficult thing. If you're looking at the individual groups that are included here, they tend to be in conflict. But at the end of the day, each of those groups understands that the state of Wyoming is a lot better off with legislation like this in place than we are without it. So it might not be perfect. It's going to be difficult to get to the point where any one group thinks it's perfect or any one individual, because there are different interests in conflict here. But the state of Wyoming is certainly a lot better off, Mr. Chairman, with legislation of this type in place, and this is certainly a good compromise and shooting for the middle ground. I'd urge the body to adopt it.
Further discussion, Senate File 32. Further discussion.
Question.
Are you ready for the question? Are all those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 32, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 32 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 73. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 73, High School Graduation Requirements, an act relating to high school graduation requirements, sponsored by Senator Coe. It was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger. Senator Coe, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, move when Committee of the Whole rise and report do so with due pass recommendation on Senate File 73. There is a standing committee amendment. I would move that at this time and ask that it be read in.
Senate File 73, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 6.
Mr. Chairman, an explanation of the bill. This goes into Wyoming Statute 212304. The duties of the State Board of Education. As you see on the bottom page one, it says the State Board of Education shall, by rule and regulation and in consultation, this is on page 2, paragraph 3, little I, coordination with local school districts, prescribe uniform student content and performance standards. You go on down that paragraph, you'll see that the ability to prescribe content and performance standards shall not be construed to give the State Board of Education the authority to prescribe textbooks or curriculum, which the State Board is hereby forbidden to do. What this bill does, members of the Senate, it goes in and says that the requirement right now under mathematics is 3 years. This goes in and says that 3 years of mathematics and one additional school year of mathematics or computer science. That's what it asks. Now, you're probably saying, why do we want to do this? There's a number of reasons. And you'll notice that we have the support pretty much of the Senate Education Committee. It's a fact out there, really, that if a student going through high school is going to have success in college, mathematics is a key driver of that. There's just no question about that. If you heard the governor's message on economic diversification, he talked about workforce and technology. Another year of math is going to have something to do with increasing the workforce and the technology requirements. We had success from the University of Wyoming in committee today. Generally speaking, students that come to the university struggle the most with math. So what this does, it provides the ability, as with Hathaway, remember that Hathaway success curriculum is 4 years of math as well. It provides the same type of resources that you would have for all students that we require right now for Hathaway. People are going to say, what about the little districts? Will they be able to do that? number of ways they can do it. First of all, the little districts are no different than any other districts right now when it comes to Hathaway. They still have to be able to provide 4 years of English, math, social studies, and science. The other side of that equation is that we do have virtual education out there, distance education, to fill that void. So I'd ask that you support the bill. We had a pretty good discussion in committee about it. It raises the rigor. No question about it. It's tougher. But as we struggle to fund schools today with less money, we need to figure out a way to get more bang for our buck so we have a better success ratio. With that, I'd ask that you support the bill. And, Mr. Chairman, if we could take up the Standing Committee Amendment at this time, I'll explain that.
Please, Senator Coe.
Standing Committee Amendment goes to page 3, section 2, and it just says this act shall apply to those students graduating on or after January 1st, 2020. We decided in committee this morning to change that to 2021. It gives another year of latitude. Stand for questions.
Discussion on Senate Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 73. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can articulate a concern of mine here. And I think Senator from Park County and the committee kind of alluded to this, but let me expand upon it. No, Mr. Chairman, I want to speak to the bill, not the amendment.
Question on the amendment. Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 73, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
That amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Further discussion, Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Please.
So here's my concern, and I think the good senator and the chairman of the Education Committee alluded to it. Math is a very difficult subject, and it's the one we see that a lot of kids that get to the university probably struggle with the most, or one of the most. But let's ask the converse of, well, what's the byproduct of 4 years of math? And I guess what I would like to know is if the committee considered the ramifications of that you might actually have students that can squeak through those lower levels of math at the high school level and get out and be very productive in other forms within our society and other careers. But does this have the potential to have negative ramifications that we might actually have students that can't graduate from high school now because they can't pass that fourth year of math because the way the math works, it's graduatedly progressive, more difficult as you go through that. And I can tell you right now, there's probably a number of students within the state of Wyoming, by the time they get through that third year of math, they're not pulling A's and B's, they're pulling D's and C's. And they're sliding through, but yet they're coming out with a high school graduation certificate. So I just like some little discussion as if there was any discussion on the negative ramifications of high school graduation rates by ramping this up.
Further discussions, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking at this. I can't help but think that this is going to increase the cost of education. I know there says it's no significant fiscal or personal impact, but I guess if I'm a school board and I'm left with the choice of providing an additional math class, then, and I want to provide all the other classes that I have before, then I guess I'm going to probably hire another math teacher and I might need another classroom. I don't know. But I think it's going to increase the cost of education. And I think the fiscal note is misleading. And I guess I look at it as that I was hoping that we wouldn't get into changing requirements and let the schools run themselves and figure out what was working and what they actually needed. A lot of these folks may not need an actual math class, but maybe they need, you know, a class on things like resumes, different things to get them into the job market. We keep forgetting about vocational training in these schools. All we're doing is saying that everybody's going to graduate high school and they're going to go to college. That's not the case, Mr. Chairman. And I really get frustrated sometimes that we keep adding more and more on the plate of the folks that are at the district level, and it just keeps getting more and more expensive.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to congratulate my good colleague from Park County for working hard to help us when we get ready to get out of high school. And, you know, I'm an engineer, and math is certainly really important to the career I chose to pursue, but I made that choice. And, you know, we're asking now that it be mandatory, and some may not want to pursue a career like I did. And there's a lot of 3 years of math, I think, is adequate for a lot of those people and those students that want to pursue a different line of work, different career. The other question I would ask is, where's this coming from? I've talked to my school board, members of my community, the teachers and students. There's no big push to say, let's have 4 years of math. I'm just wondering, what's the impetus of the bill and who is asking for this and where it's coming from?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the bill. I think there was the concern was raised that, well, what about, are you going to discourage students from graduating from high school? And I've seen a very personal example, individual that really struggled with math. It was a great difficulty for him. And I don't know whether it was a high school requirement or a wise guidance counselor that said, okay, you need that fourth year of math, but it's not, you know, the regular algebra, geometry, trigonometry, progression. Take business math. It amounted to a pretty good review of the practical math that people need in day-to-day applications. It was a struggle for the kid, but he took it, got that extra year of math, the fourth year of math, went out to the world of work, and thank goodness he took that, because the job he's got right now requires that degree of mathematics. And if he hadn't taken the fourth year, he would really be behind the eight ball doing the work that he really wants to. And it, you know, this says math or computer science. You do have some latitude in what that fourth year of math is, and the guidance counselor can put the students into the right class, and maybe there's a few of our absolute smallest schools that might have a problem. I don't think so. I think there will be a math course they can find that will fit the students that have the struggle, that need the extra year to master some of the basics that maybe the first, second, and third year of math would teach the more advanced students. So I think this is a very good requirement. Our world is becoming so technical and so mathematical. Yeah, this will help with the kids that are getting the remedial work in the colleges, but it will also be a big help for the kids that are going out into the world of work who need that extra exposure to math to be able to master the math that so many of our current jobs require.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to rise in support of this bill. And then on third reading, I'm going to have my name taken off as sponsor. But what I would like to say is simply this. The reason why I put my name on this bill is because I really like the computer science piece, and that gives kids an option. But the problem with the bill, and we discussed this in committee, is simply students have so many periods throughout the semester. Typically, they have a 6, 7, or even an 8 period day. And
when you take up that period, they lose an elective. And in this particular case, they're going to lose an elective in their senior year. So this will require either high school seniors either taking a math or taking a computer science course. And I think the good senator from Goshen County was absolutely correct, is that we are going to require additional math teachers or additional computer science teacher. And it's come to my attention that a computer science teacher is very, very difficult to find, as is an additional math teacher. But at least in my district, I have my school board already requiring 4 years of math, and then the Hathaway already requires 4 years of math. So it really doesn't make all that much difference to the area that I represent. But in the long run, I'm always concerned about those kids who need career technical education. And in my community, that is absolutely crucial. I have to have diesel mechanics. I have to have welders. I have to have people who can go out and work on rigs. I have to have that. And I know a good senator from Natrona County has said, well, they do need that. But those kids are incredibly frustrated, and they've had 3 years of math. And they're fed up with the system. And the only way we lots of times can keep them is through our career technical education. And so I really struggle with this bill. I like certain parts of it, and then there's other parts that really concern me deeply. So I will bring an amendment on third reading. I will be absent off from the floor on tomorrow to strike my name from the bill.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I just got to thinking, we've got a great community college in our district, and I think a lot of the other folks do too. And, you know, there's probably a lot of fine arts majors, people that want to maybe go to culinary school. If you're in LCCC, they've got a great culinary project. And you can have that basically dual and concurrent enrollment in your community colleges. And so if you're an English major and you can take English at your community college, or you're a music major and you can take music, or if you want to be a culinary person, you can take a culinary class at LCCC. But if you got to take the extra math course, then, well, no, you can't do that. So you're taking options away. And the guidance counselors are the people that are supposed to, you know, lead you the way. And a lot of people, if they're going to go on an engineering or a technical thing, yeah, they're going to take that fourth period. But if you're not going on, we're basically tying their hands, and we're telling them on this floor, we know best for you. We know more than your guidance counselor does, because you should take 4 years of math.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, on and for the legislation. To address a couple of points, first of all, with regard to the cost and whether it will cost more, the answer is it won't cost more, and the reason being that we have a block grant model for educational funding. So funds may have to be reallocated, and things will happen within the district, but the reason there is no change in the budget is because there is not going to be a change in the budget. That's just the nature of the block grant funding model. As far as where this comes from and what the impetus is for this, the impetus is really that we want to improve the marketability for our students of themselves after graduation. We want to improve the workforce skills looking towards the 21st century and not looking back to the 20th century. And recognizing that an essential skill in that future marketplace is going to be computer science, mathematics, and that none of the degrees, none of the careers that we've discussed here as career and technical education are math-free degrees. In fact, I can't really think of any real good career that doesn't use mathematics that people wouldn't want to hone those skills, as well as the idea that on the Education Committee, we're trying to prepare people to be both college and career ready. That's the emphasis that the Joint Education Committee has focused on. And it's not a college or career ready where we select students in high school and say this group is going to be career ready, but not college ready. This group is going to be college ready. It's a college and career ready. The idea that everyone graduating will have opportunities in either space. And we know from testimony that fourth year of mathematics makes a substantial difference in college readiness. If you take 3 years, the standard algebra, algebra 2, and geometry, and you look nationwide at the scores on the ACT test, it's a 10% college-ready rate. That's all it is. If you go to that fourth year, you more than triple that rate, and depending on what your class is, you get up into the 60 percentile for college readiness on the benchmark indicator for mathematics. The fourth year makes a tremendous difference. We know that as the Joint Education Committee is trying to improve scores, improve qualities of the graduates, as we're meeting workplace demands, this is the single most important thing that we could do to improve those scores. We've heard it for the last 6+ years, and we recognize that a change that needs to be made to ensure that all of our Wyoming graduates are ready for either college or career is going to be this fourth year of mathematics. Mr. Chairman, hopefully the body will support this, and it's a very positive step for our students.
Further discussions, Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill, and I don't doubt what we just heard. I don't doubt that at all, and I think that the Wyoming has taken a number of steps to do that. We've provided a significant positive reinforcement and encouragement to take that fourth year of math and computer science. It's in the Hathaway. Any guidance counsel will tell you that that's important for your college readiness and important for the scores. The reason that I think this is not the right way to go, Mr. Chairman, is simply it's those kids that are hanging on by their teeth, just by their fingernails are hanging on there. And most of you probably visited those programs where you've got a program over here where you're doing alternative education because you're trying. These kids, some of these kids are homeless. Some of these kids have come from absolutely horrible family environments, and so they're in there just trying to hang on by their fingernails. And so you provide programs where they pick up some extra math, but it's in the form of figuring out how to do a fourth of a cup and a teaspoon and how many teaspoons are in a tablespoon, and how many tablespoons are in a fourth of a cup, and so you get all that stuff. They do it in their construction classes where they figure out angles and they're doing that. So they pick up those types of things. But if we present that as a math class, I'm afraid I can tell you right now that in a couple of programs that I've visited, we're probably in Natrona County we'd probably lose 25 to 30 graduates by doing that. And these kids are just hanging on by their teeth. There, some of them are working jobs, some of them have kids, and they're just hanging in there. And now we laid this other brick on, and my real concern is I know it would do them good. It would be great to have them do it, but what we've got to do is somehow get these kids along, because not getting that diploma, we know what the effect of that is. We know what the long range effect that is on not getting that diploma, and we pass up this one hurdle. And we take another 20, 30, 50 kids, 100 kids around the state, and we end up creating this negative incentive for them to continue on and get their high school diploma. Those kids end up with a lifelong disability because they don't have that diploma. And I think it's absolutely right that we encourage them with guidance counselors. We encourage them, showing them how that'll help them. We encourage them with the Hathaway and other scholarships, but to force it on them, I think, is the wrong way to go. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sometimes think we decide what's right for the world by our backgrounds. You know, if I'm a math guy, I think that the world would be a lot better if you all had more math. You know, but if I was an English teacher at a literary major, which I wish I was better at that, I might think that we're turning out students that aren't that literate, that can't write very well. And maybe we could do a better job if we turned this around and had more English and more attention in that area. I might also say the same thing about ethics, perhaps. Maybe I feel that we're turning out students that perhaps haven't really thought about philosophy, ethics, big picture things, maybe biblical literature. But what I'm trying to say, Mr. Chairman, is that your point of view kind of comes about from where you've been. And it seems to me that science, technology, mathematics, that's kind of running the day now. And it's a good thing. All the projections are the jobs are going to be here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But kids aren't always that way, Mr. Chairman. They kind of work their way through the world. I am concerned there's probably, this will probably help some kids in the middle to be better at math. All right? The kids on the bottom end, I tell you, this will be a very negative thing for them. The kids at the top end, they're already doing it. They want to be an engineer. They want to do this. They're already there. So you're kind of nudging the kids in the middle. But all these things aren't free. It's not the money. It's the freedom that you'd have to take something else. You know, at a time in your life, your fourth year, when you're finding out what you want to do and you want to explore different things, and I think the question about taking dual credit classes at a university or college, amazing. So we could be foreclosing that from happening. And I guess the whole point of what I'm trying to say is I don't think we actually know that it's the right thing to have 4 years of math for kids. I think it's good in a lot of instances, but I don't think anybody here can actually say that's the right thing for every kid. And I don't think we should put it in law.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, on and opposed, a lot of great stuff both sides, and just a little observation from the side on things. I truly believe we're going to lose kids. You add this on. But beyond that, this bill's going to, actually, if we just keep moving, we're going to head down the path. We don't need curriculum directors anymore because the legislature is going to have dictated every single thing our kids do. You know, we've done class sizes for kindergarten. We move and we move and we move. And when are we going to start letting our people that are trained to educate our kids tell us what the kids need, not the legislature dictate to them in reverse? I'm seeing that every day. That's part of the problems we're having with our funding in education. We've added so many things for our education system. This is one more brick on that, and we continue to. Each time we do it, we add costs to our entire system and make it more difficult for our kids to get out of school. Let's let educators educate and legislators legislate. Let's defeat this bill and start letting our educators do it.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you. Just one final note. Spent a little time on this good committee. They weren't knocking down our door asking for this one. And to say it doesn't cost money, eventually everything costs money. So, all right, I come from that committee now that everything costs money. So put a big no on this one. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not the final note. Just along those same lines, what this would mean for a small school district would be a school district to make the decision of either crimping down the curriculum they offer even more, which means the senior that wants to take the business math, it's not offered for that senior to take that business math, that particular class hour. Or the school district would take the other option and hire another math teacher to broaden their curriculum offer even more. So even though they have the same block grant formula, it will cost those smaller districts more money if they want to expand their curriculum. And that would happen. I mean, that's just a fact. So it will affect the smaller school districts. And maybe this the larger districts would slide into this very easily. But we're putting these students into a pigeonhole. The incentive is already there with the Hathaway. We've talked about this. I'd like to see the dust settle just a few years without having to make any changes to our curriculum that we offer in the state of Wyoming, and let the test scores come in. And I appreciate the education committee's efforts on this, but it's going to affect smaller school districts more so than the larger school districts, which is unfair. It's just unfair. We've already seen a lot of differences in the block grant formula. We don't have AstroTurf on our football field. I represent a lot of small school districts. So there's some disparity there that we have to address somewhere along this line. But let's let the dust settle on this curriculum and put this thing to rest.
Senate File 73, further discussion, Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to give you another scenario that's a little converse to this, but I think it's poignant from a standpoint that you may have the best and the brightest, and you have a student that has already passed 3 years of math and could have taken a junior college level math class. They've excelled. They've met all your, and this is a real life scenario. You're going to have some of these really, really bright kids that really get math, but it's not their calling in life. What you've effectively done, you've taken the choice away from the best and the brightest to take an elective that may steer them in a direction in their life that they may be the greatest pianist in the world or the greatest welder, but they can excel at mathematics. And what we've told is we don't care what level of excellence that you get to in 3 years. We're going to mandate now that you still have to even excel at a higher level. That's an unintended consequence of this bill. But I think it, even for the best and brightest, it starts to limit your choice on and against the bill.
For the discussion on the bill, Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, good debate. You know, I brought this because I believe and I've listened year after year about everybody saying that we spend incredible amounts of money on education and don't get the results we want. This would be a tool out there that would help, I think, get results that we're looking forward to. Remember as well that in our community colleges, 46% of high school graduates from Wyoming high schools that go to community colleges go into remedial math. 46%. That's a hard number. UW doesn't do remediation. A couple years ago, they've got a great diesel school down at Western Wyoming College, and one of the major producers down in that part of the state said, we need kids if they're going to be diesels, working on diesels, whatever they're doing, they got to have math and they got to have computer skills. That's what's going on out there in the real world. So vote it up or vote it down. I have a perception that if I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, it might be the train coming this time. But I think it would start us down that road to get better results for success, for graduation, and for vo-ed stuff. As kids leave our high schools, this would be a tool that would increase that performance.
Senator Barnard.
Chairman, rising on and for this bill, I was told from the time I was a little boy that I needed to take all the math in high school I could take, and I did. And when I got to college, I had a TA that taught me a calculus class from India. I could barely understand what he was saying. And if I hadn't had that trigonometry and introduction to calculus in high school, I wouldn't have been able to get into optometry school, because you have to have calculus to get into practically any profession. So I think we're doing our students a big disservice if they don't take this. Also, Mr. Chairman, if we have 4 years of math, the teachers in the grade schools on up are going to say, hey, you have to learn this. Some of these kids say, I don't need to learn math because I'm only going to have maybe two or three courses in it. But if they say you're going to say four years of math, they're going to say, I better get down, I better learn this, grow up and study the math and get through it.
Further discussion? Question. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 73, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Senate File 73 has failed the... Right. Okay. Has a... motion to adopt... where the hell am I now? Senate File 73, having...
No.
Okay, Senate File 73, having failed a voice vote. Division haven't been called for. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt standing... To adopt Senate File 73, please stand. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed, please stand. Now we go to roll call. Senate File 73 has... It's 19 to... The vote is...
9 yes, 19 no.
9 yes, 19 no. Senate File 73 having failed a standing division vote. Clerk will now please call the roll pursuant to Rule 6-5. Roll call vote is required.
Agar?
No.
No. Anderson?
No.
No. Anselmi Dalton?
No.
No. Baldwin?
No.
No. Barnard?
Yes.
Yes. Boner?
No.
No. Bouchard?
No.
No. Burns excused. Case?
No.
No. Christensen?
No.
No. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
No.
No. Driscoll?
No.
No. Ellis?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
No.
No. Kinski?
No.
No. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer? No. Moniz?
No.
No. Nethercott?
No.
No. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
No.
No. Peterson?
No.
No. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern? No. Wasserberger?
No.
No. President Bebout?
No.
No. Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 9 aye, 20 no, 1 excused.
Senate File 73, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Mr. Senator Driscoll. Hang on a minute. Let me get your name. Mic on. Let me get your mic on.
He can have his name removed from the list if it's legal to have your name removed as a sponsor. I'd like a ruling from the chair, please.
Senator Wasserberger, the bill having failed, do you still feel like you need to have your name removed from the bill? All right. Senator Wasserberger.
Mr. Chairman, that is unnecessary at this time, but when I was... in the House, a good senator from Albany County had amended a good legislator from Natrona County's bill so much that the Natrona County representative got up on third reading and removed his name from the bill, and that, I believe, is appropriate.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Driscoll.
I know the other side does things differently than we do. I was asking what we do on this side.
Point of order.
Senator Case, point of order.
Mr. Chairman, I think the issue of whether he can bring in a motion to remove from the bill or not is moot. The bill has passed or has failed Committee of the Whole. That's the final disposition of the bill. It's a moot question at this time. We could try it again on another bill.
That's the ruling of the chair. Senator Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Mr. President.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 10, do pass amended. Senate File 2, do pass amended. Senate File 63, do pass amended. Senate File 29, do pass. Senate File 66, do pass amended. Senate File 69, do pass. Senate File 6, do pass amended. Senate File 67, do pass. Senate Joint Resolution 2, do pass. Senate File 37, do pass amended. Senate File 32, do pass amended. Senate File 73, failed to pass the Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senator Kinski, Chairman.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
Heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion is adopted. The Committee of the Whole is adopted. We're going to stand at ease until the sound of the gavel. We'll take about a 5 or 10 minute break.
No, just plain. Just plain old. Hi. Oh. I'm standing guard while everybody.
I tried to.
Ellen? Senate will come back to order. We're at that order of business, adoption of rules. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. I think we're back here. So I guess we're going to go back and move. I guess right now we have to move Senate File 3, which is the amendment that we just talked about. So, Mr. President, I'd move that Senate Rule 3 be adopted as an amendment to the rule.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader,
yes?
We haven't passed on any of the rules related back, so we're at the adoption of the rules, and you would go through the same script.
We would start over?
Yes.
Like we never did it before. We're going to do nunk-pro-tunk. All right, here we go. I move the Senate rules and joint rules previously adopted as temporary rules to the Senate of the 64th Legislature, together with any amendments adopted by the Senate, be adopted as the permanent rules of the Senate of the 64th Legislature.
You heard the motion. Before voting on the motion to adopt the temporary rules as a permanent rule, the Senate will first consider any proposed amendments to the temporary rules. Amendments to the temporary rules require majority votes for adoption. We have three of those. First one is Senate Rule 1. Reading clerk, please read the Senate Rule 1.
Senate Rule 1. Senate Rule 12-2 is amended to read.
Mr. Vice President.
Mr. President, I move Senate Rule 1, which is 12-2, disclosure of personal or private interest. And further explanation, I think I've given that, and I would ask that if there is any amendments to present, that it be done at this time.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I've got an amendment labeled SR3 that would amend proposed Senate Rule 1. Mr. President, I would suggest that we read that in and then I'll move it.
Yeah, what we're going to do, we're going to take these amendments in the order they were filed and work accordingly. So we have a motion on Senate Rule Number 1. Further discussion?
Mr. President.
Senator Scott.
The Senate Rule 3 is an amendment to Senate Rule 1, and we ought to vote on it before we vote on Senate Rule 1, Mr. President, I think.
We can do it either way, Senator Scott. If you feel better that way, we can certainly do that. We've had a motion to move Senate Rule 1, and you're going to now move your motion to amend it. Is that correct? Senator Scott, the floor is yours.
Mr. President, yes. I would like to have it read in so I can move.
Would you read in that? It would be Senate Rule 3. Reading clerk, please read the Senate Rule 3.
Senate Rule 3, to amend Senate Rule 1 as follows.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I move this amendment to Senate Rule 1. What it does is it adds the words personal or so that it recognizes that there is a personal interest that is beyond just financial interests, Mr. President. And I think that's very important because we do encounter those instances here in the Senate. I've seen a number of times where people have declared a personal private interest on confirmation of a relative. That's been the custom in the Senate. You declare conflict on that. We also had an instance, I was informed, and I think I recall it, where a member declared a conflict because of service on a nonprofit board where they weren't getting a financial gain, but they still had very much a personal interest in the subject matter. And so that does arise as well. And we need to have that recognition in the rules. I will say the Rules Committee, in another year, you might well be able to come up with a better wording, but this will get us by till then because it does provide a recognition that there's something other than just financial interests. So I urge the adoption.
Further discussion? Okay. The question before you is Amendment SR3, which is an amendment to SR1. Chief Clerk, call the roll.
Agar?
Aye.
Aye. Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Anselmi Dalton?
Aye.
Aye. Baldwin?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Bouchard?
Aye.
Aye. Burns excused. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Excused.
Ellis?
Aye.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Hinsky?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Moniz?
Aye.
Aye. Nethercott?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Fladern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Bebout.
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 28 aye, 2 excused.
By your vote, Senate Rule Number 3, Amendment to Senate Rule 1 has passed the Senate. Now we're back on Senate Rule 1. Further discussion. Senate Rule 1 is amended. Further discussion. Chief Clerk, call the roll on Senate Rule 1 as amended.
Agar?
Aye.
Aye. Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Anselmi Dalton?
Aye.
Aye. Baldwin?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Bouchard?
Aye.
Aye. Burns? Excuse. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll excused. Ellis?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich? Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Moniz?
Aye.
Aye. Nethercott? Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Baumflatern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger? Aye. President Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 28 aye, 2 excused.
By your vote, we have adopted Senate Rule 2 as amended to our joint rules. We have one more amendment, Senate Rule. Senate Rule 1. I'm sorry, I said Senate Rule 2. Correction is, by your vote, you have adopted Senate Rule 2. Senate Rule 1 is amended by Senate Rule 3. Now we're on Senate Rule 2. Senator Scott. Senator Perkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that Senate Rule 2 be adopted as an amendment to the rules. Senate Rule 2, Mr. President, is amending Senate Rule 7-6. What we do is you see there that we add a new last sentence that only procedural objections to the bill being read a third time are in order on second reading. The purpose of this bill and the thought of the committee as we move forward was, if you'll just hearken back to our, I think it was Friday, that we had a little bit of a kerfuffle on second reading, and in doing this, looking at that, a couple things came to mind. Is one that the generally, and looking at, there could be procedural or there could be substantive objections. The point of having a procedural objection here is making sure that if there's a re-referral, if there's something happened in the process of the bill getting to this point, that it be corrected at second reading. Otherwise, what would happen is that would simply move to third reading. The effect and the reason why I think the overarching issue was concerning mischief and the ability to slow down the process. And ultimately, you could have turn around and have without a second reading amendment, you could end up debating and having the exact same debate and back same arguments you had on committee of the whole, and thereby slow down the process significantly. And so ultimately, you still can bring, and we still would be debating any kind of amendment on second reading, but otherwise, with the addition of this amendment, it would clarify that the only objections that would be in order at second reading would be a procedure objection, and that further substantive objections on the bill itself would be out of order. With that, would stand for questions and would urge your.
Did the reading clerk read this in? I don't believe we did.
I don't recall.
We didn't read it in. Would you please read it in?
It's Senate Rule 2. Senate Rule 7-6 is amended as follows.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move that. Senate Rule 2. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. President, frankly, I came to the Rules Committee with a proposed rule that went the other way and regularized the procedure that we did use on the second reading vote. And it's been something the Senate has on rare occasion done over the years. I can recall a particular senator from Sheridan County that had a good deal of success on the principle of when you see a snake, kill it, and disposed of certain bills on second reading. And frankly, the discussion in Rules Committee, Mr. President, convinced me that, although I think the instance where it was done last week was appropriate because it was curing the fact the Appropriations Committee was off the floor on a very close vote in Committee of the Whole, the Rules Committee was much more concerned if at some point in the future we get some real obstructionist in here, they might be able to slow the process down a lot, and that we didn't want to do that. So I think this, Mr. President, I think this rule is a good one. We ought to adopt it. I will warn you that if you adopt this, I am going to claim the distinction of having been the last senator to kill a bill on second reading.
Senator Meyer.
Understand the objections to some procedural mischief, but I guess I look at it, and let's say somebody's here on second reading and they want to kill a bill, and they're not going to be here on third reading, and maybe they've got to, you know, attend a funeral or something else, and they can't be here and they can't make their argument. Would they still have the ability to make their argument, even though they're not on third reading, about why they want the bill killed? I don't think they could. I don't know whether or not they'd be recognized. So that's a question I'd have, is whether somebody would be recognized in that situation where they weren't able to meet third reading. I always thought you could kill a bill anytime you wanted to, when it could possibly come up for a vote. And now we're basically saying second reading, you might as well just move to third reading and forget about it. You don't even need second reading. You want to save time on procedures, just unanimous consent on second reading and slap the gavel and go on. You don't have to call every bill. So I'm not sure where we're going with this one, Mr. President.
Mr. President, in answer to that specific point, if you know at the time of second reading you're going to be absent in third and have strong feelings about it, I think it would be in order to request that the bill laid back, and I think the customs of the Senate have been such that that request would be honored. And I think that's probably the better remedy.
Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. And, Mr. President, the second reading traditionally and by rule is not a reading to kill bills. It's a rule for amendment. And so if there are amendments available, then you're going to raise those amendments, and there's going to be a possibility of debate, but still an expectation that it will go to reading three. So the idea that this somehow changes tradition and obviates the entirety of second reading, I don't agree with. I think this is very consistent with the purpose of second reading and just clarifies that only a procedural objection would be recognized at that time. Otherwise, it will be an opportunity for amendment, and then there will be a further opportunity for amendment and debate on third reading prior to the final vote. So on and for this rule change.
Further discussion? Further discussion? We're voting on Senate Rule 2. Will the reading clerk please call the roll?
Agar? No. Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Anselmi Dalton?
Aye.
Aye. Baldwin?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
No.
No. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Bouchard?
No.
No. Burns excused. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen? Aye. Co.
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter.
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll. Excused. Ellis.
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich.
Aye.
Aye. Hastert.
Aye.
Aye. Hicks.
No.
No. Kinski.
Aye.
Aye. Landon.
Aye.
Aye. Meyer.
No.
No. Moniz.
No.
No. Nethercott. Aye. Pappas.
Aye.
Aye. Perkins.
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Bebout?
Aye.
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 23 aye, 6 no, 1 excused.
By your vote, you voted to adopt Senate Rule 2. Okay, we're going to vote on the Senate rules as amended. Further discussion? Further discussion? Senate rules as amended. Chief Clerk, call the roll.
Agar?
Aye.
Aye. Anderson?
Excused.
Excused. Anselmi Dalton?
Aye.
Aye. Baldwin?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Boner? Aye. Bouchard?
Aye.
Aye. Burns excused. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstader?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Ellis?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Moniz?
Aye.
Nethercott? Aye. Pappas? Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Fladern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 29 aye, 1 excused.
By your vote, you voted to adopt the temporary rules as amended to become the permanent rules of the 64th Senate. Mr. Majority, are there any reports from standing committees? Reports from the House? Nothing? Mr. Majority Floor, I believe that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move we adjourn until 10 a.m.
Tuesday, January 17th.
10 a.m.
Announcements. Senator Meyer.
President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet in about 15 minutes. It'll go 4:45 and S-27 to look at the following bills here. Senate File 54, Military Spouse Hiring Preference. Senate File 55, Anti-Discrimination Military Spouses. Again, if anybody's interested in these preference bills, we'll have some good testimony.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your Joint Appropriation number 2 going to be meeting in L-55, take off 3 referrals, 35, virtual education, 42, opiate overdose, 81, circuit court judge salaries. And tomorrow morning, Mr. Chairman, 8 a.m. L-55, we'll be going over governor's letters, livestock board callback, Department of Family Services callback, and at 12 noon, callbacks for the Department of Health and Department of Transportation. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your travel committee number 6 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., Journal Room S-27, to consider Senate File 60, Antelope Hunts, Senate File 24, Film Industry Financial Incentive Program.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, 30 minutes after noon recess, in Journal Room S-19 to consider Senate File 23, Fuel Tax Appeals, and Senate File 11, License Revocation Process.
Other announcements? You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate will stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Tuesday, January 17th, with Senator Von Fladern and Senator Perkins. Please approach the chair. I told you.